I'm not quite sure how to go about my question, but let me go about it the following way. I'm going to argue that the colloquium and what I'm talking about now, what I talked about in the last half of the last lecture, are sort of the same kind of thing. That they shed considerable light on each other, if you looked at it in the right way. What makes them similar? Yes?
It's a sort of empirical fact that was used in this guy's research was that if you take just any distribution and you run it through the Sloan mission, you end up with a certain kind of distribution, an equilibrium distribution.
Good, you got there. Took a while, but you got there. The word equilibrium is shared between the two things. What was the subject of discussion yesterday at the colloquium was a formulation of a super quantum mechanics which had a non-equilibrium behavior, which was super-duper, and then in equilibrium relaxed to the quantum mechanics that we know and learn in courses. This set of lectures, yes, last half of yesterday's lecture, today, and probably tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about the dynamics of classical mechanics, talking about how the dynamics of classical mechanics relaxes to the equilibrium that we know as statistical mechanics. Now, the speaker yesterday used a fundamental technique for understanding when things could be out of equilibrium. As I understand it, you all might want to correct me or help me with it. As I understand it, he estimated relaxation times, time constants, from microscopic considerations, and said that you had to have something that was had shorter times in it than those fundamental time constants. If you had longer time constants, then the thing would relax to equilibrium. Now, we know a lot about equilibrium from our experience with the everyday world. I think he wasn't emphasizing very much what we know from the everyday world. If I look out the window, I'm looking through window glass. Is window glass at equilibrium? It's a liquid, and the equilibrium state of that material would be a crystalline solid. What is the time constant of that material? What is a fundamental microscopic time constant? One level for relaxation, it's supposed to be years. However, the microscopic time constant is either the time constant that it takes electrons to relax, which is about 10 to the minus 15 seconds, or the time constant that it takes the ions to relax, which is 10 to the minus 12 seconds, or 10 to the minus 10 seconds at the outside. That stuff has been around a factor of, the glass in that window, has been around a factor of 10 to the 23rd, more than 10 to the 23rd, longer than the fundamental microscopic time constant. That's a remarkable fact. That suggests that it's simply estimating a microscopic time constant is not the only thing that you need to do in order to figure out whether a system is in equilibrium. Okay, that's one example. Let me choose another example. In a gas like the atmosphere around us, what the fundamental time constant is, anybody know what it is? How long is the time between collisions? It's 10 to the minus 8 seconds or 10 to the minus 7 seconds, a pretty short time. Therefore, it follows as swiftly as night follows day that the atmosphere is in equilibrium. Yes? Well, if we're in equilibrium, the temperature up in the stratosphere would be the same as the temperature down here. And that's simply not true. So our experience with gases and our experience with solids both belie the notion that the fundamental time constant is the only thing that can determine the relaxation to equilibrium. I would argue that physics, yes, please. It is certainly true for the atmosphere, for the gases in the atmosphere, that you describe it by a local temperature and a local velocity, wind velocity, and a local density, what is the partial pressure of nitrogen in the atmosphere. In that sense, it looks like it's in equilibrium. But on the other hand, if you wanted to understand what was going on with the weather, you would not necessarily want to use an equilibrium theory of the atmosphere. You would only want to use, as you suggest, a local equilibrium theory of the atmosphere. I guess I'm arguing that you can't figure out everything in your head. It isn't enough to be able to take and figure out time constants by thinking about what the what comes along. Nature teaches us that there are that the internal dynamics of things develop their own time constants. We had rotten weather for a week, 2 weeks here. That's one time constant of developed by the atmosphere, naturally, internally, not asking for a moment about what the internal relaxation time of a molecule is. We have to wait a long time, a very, very long time, to see the full liquid relaxation of the glass and the glass slump down and make a puddle. In fact, it is somewhat controversial as to whether it will ever do so. In fact, we do not understand the behavior of glasses very well. We don't know exactly why a glass has all of these funny time constants. We don't know why a glass has, if you look at the frequency spectrum of the various things that happen in it, things happening in it over all frequencies between years and picoseconds. We don't understand all that. And it is important to recognize, as one does one part of physics, that there are lessons to be learned from other parts of physics. The condensed matter physics tells us that systems which obey things even as simple as partial differential equations. Partial differential equations are pieces of mathematics that have been around for several hundred years. And the stuff that we thought, in some qualitative fashion, we understood. But partial differential equations develop their own time constants, and you get a spectrum of times in them that you can not say you fully understand. For example, the turbulent behavior of the atmosphere of any fluid is not fully understood. For example, glassy behavior is not fully understood. Those are tough problems that we don't know how to attack, and we don't know exactly how to predict the various time constants involved. We can't even predict in a qualitative fashion. And as one thinks about other problems in nature, one should recognize the richness and complexity that we have already learned about. There is, I'm not sure I should say it, but there's a difference of opinion between people who do particle physics and who do condensed matter physics about what happens between this scale that we look at by using the Large Hadron Collider or other machines that are available to us, and the Planck scale. Our experience in condensed matter physics suggests that qualitatively new physics occurs every couple of decades as you change length scales. That means that there's room for 8 new theories, maybe more, in between the Planck scale and where we are. That, that means that from the perspective of a condensed matter physicist, one should worry a little bit about whether one can do predictions at the Planck scale by the using the information we have available now or will have available with a Large Hadron Collider. With that commercial message, I will go look for my stick. Where's my stick? Don't have a stick. Have to use my hand. Okay. We got past this. What we said was the, thank you very much. What we said was that the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution was produced by this little model of Einstein in which we had a stochastic description of Brownian motion in which our piece of pollen was getting hit all the time by little particles. And then we went on to look at what was the dynamics of classical mechanics. And we said that before we did the dynamics of classical mechanics, it behooved us to do general dynamics and see how a function of x, how a function of a general dynamical variable would behave, and how a probability density would behave if we had a general dynamical variable. What we concluded was that if we had a general dynamical variable, which obeyed, it's a time derivative of some function. The dynamical variable obeyed, the x dt is velocity, which depends on x and t. And we then figured out what the probability density for x's would equation that would obey, and we picked up a term in it which we were perhaps not expecting, that term being this one, which says that the time derivative is not only produced by stuff which is directly the change of x's, as we might have expected, but also produced by a divergence, dxj, vj, summed over j, that divergence being the dilation of the volume elements in the system. All of this is a lead up to doing a classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, we have two kinds of variables, q alpha and p alpha. Dq alpha dt and dp alpha dt are respectively minus plus dh dp alpha and minus dh dq alpha. And these are the equations of classical mechanics. These equations in classical mechanics are very, very special in that this term, this divergence term, is going to go away. And we are going to get no dilation of volume elements. The result is called Liouville's theorem. And I guess I should show you how that, that thing behaves. Vj comes in two terms. There's a Vp, which is minus dh dq, and a Vq, which is plus dh dp. I just left off the indices alpha here. You have to sum over those indices in your head. The dilation term is the derivative of Vp with respect to p. The dilation term is the derivative with respect to p of Vp plus the derivative with respect to q of Vq. And that's equal to the derivative with respect to p, Vp being minus dh dq, and Vq being plus dh dp. And that is this thing plus this thing. And since you can always interchange the order of differentiation, that's zero. That divergence term is always zero in classical mechanics. Classical mechanics is really very special indeed. And so the equations for classical mechanics look like the following. The time derivative of the density matrix, the probability density, is dh dp times the derivative of that rho with respect to q, minus dh dq times the derivative of that rho with respect to p. Or any function of p and q has the same structure because the divergence term is lacking, except that that there's a minus sign in this equation relative to that one. One more special result is that the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to time is equal to zero if there is no, if the Hamiltonian has no explicit time dependence. If the Hamiltonian, for example, is of the form p squared over 2m, that's no explicit time dependence. I'm ruling out the p squared over 2m times some function of t. That's not what's going on. So this is no explicit time dependence. Then the entire time dependence of the Hamiltonian is given by its dependence on p and q. This is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p times the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to q minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to q times the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p. A nice way of writing zero. So the time derivative of the Hamiltonian is equal to zero
if there is no explicit time dependence. Okay, is this clear? Please ask your question.
It's a pretty good way to treat generally any case where you have uncertainty in some probability distribution in the position of particles, right?
Well, yes and no. If I have an equation in which I have, for example, dp dt is equal to minus p over tau, then vp is minus p over tau, and the derivative of vp with respect to p is minus 1 over tau. So in that case, we do have this dilation term.
Yeah, okay, but I just mean this whole technique starting from the beginning and giving a probability distribution. So how does that relate to quantum mechanics, where we have all sorts of probability distributions in that?
It doesn't relate very nicely to quantum mechanics. So that is
quantum mechanics has an entirely different probability structure, which I will describe to you with the exception of science, which will drive me crazy and will I'm going to get wrong. So let me tell you about the probability structure of quantum mechanics. I believe I did not put that on the slide, which said I did all of quantum mechanics on one slide. The probability structure of quantum mechanics is all contained in a matrix called rho, just to confuse you. That matrix called rho obeys a Hamiltonian equation of motion, which is IHDT rho is rho commutator Hamiltonian. And the sign here is, bless me, unknown to me at the moment. It's different from the sign for any respectable variable. This respectable variable has a, when you calculate its time dependence, has a minus sign. Okay? You can have a situation with a pure state. That says that the system at a time rho of 0 is a pure state. If you stick it into this equation, that pure state will stay pure forever. If, however, you have, for example, a mixture of two pure states, and to get the normalization right, I would put a 1/2 in there, with alpha and beta having zero overlap, this behavior is different from the pure state behavior. And this behavior is a behavior which we can describe as the overlap of two states in one representation, but it is not, this is not representation independent. That is, if I changed my basis states, I would begin to get off-diagonal behavior. If I that in general, what we do is we have a row which is off-diagonal, which has the properties that the trace of row is equal to 1 in order to make it into a respectable probability. And then we would calculate the average of any x as the trace of rho times x. For example, we might indeed try to calculate the entropy as the trace, the minus sign, I believe, of rho log rho. A logarithm of a Hermitian matrix. This matrix is Hermitian. I define it to be Hermitian. The logarithm of a Hermitian matrix is perfectly well defined. so that, especially under a trace operation, so this is a well-defined thing. And if it's in a pure state, it's this S is zero. If it's in a mixed state like this, S is not zero, and we can talk about entropies. However, this is a whole different kettle of fish from classical mechanics. And the exact way in which this goes into rho of P, Q, T is a story which is yet to be told fully. It has to do with entanglement and other rich, exciting subjects, and I think we do not fully understand how that classical limit of the probability density of quantum mechanics enters. Therefore, it was, as the previous lecture said, not part of the thing that I was going to talk about, and I just talked about it because I was asked. Further questions? Not that I object to being asked. I'm perfectly happy to listen and try to answer your questions.
It's just detailed in your slide in the last paragraph, right in particular, H,
if H is the Hamiltonian, assumed to be a function of the P's and Q's, but not containing any other T dependence, then dH dt equals zero, i.e. H is independent of time.
So you're using P.11 when X is...
Yes, that this is a consequence of V11 and is a the result, in words, of what you get out of V11. In fact, anything which is independent of time, if you stick it in here, you get out zero. If you put the total momentum in a situation in which you have momentum conserved, you get zero coming out on the right. You will, basically, because total momentum is conserved in situations in which the Hamiltonian has a translation invariance in space, and then you play some games with that, and the translation invariance in space implies directly that this term goes away. This term goes away, and then this term. I'm not prepared to do it. In any case, you can use the translational invariance in space to prove that the time derivative of the momentum is zero in the appropriate situation. Okay? Further questions, comments? Onward. I rearranged the slides last night, so I've forgotten exactly where I am. Okay. To make the connection between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics, to make it correctly but somewhat obscurely, that is, it's hard to figure out what this connection is, and this doesn't entirely help us. A Poisson bracket is defined as the Poisson bracket of F and G is dF dQ alpha times dG dP alpha minus g dq alpha df dp alpha. That is, the time derivative of rho is the Poisson bracket of h with rho. The Poisson bracket of x is the Poisson bracket of x with h. And I think I got the signs correct. This thing is anti-symmetric, so if we interchange the two guys in it, you get a minus sign. That's the fundamental minus sign in the difference between the time dependence of rho and the time dependence of any physical quantity. The Poisson bracket, this was supposed to make the connection with quantum mechanics. The Poisson brackets are rather like the commutators of quantum mechanics. In particular, you have this thing which is called the Jacobi identity, which says that these things just satisfy in virtue of partial differential equation stuff, this bracket relationship, these should be, this should be a bracket like that, not a bracket like that. The same kind of relation is true for operators in quantum mechanics, with this kind of bracket replaced by commutators. The bracket relations for classical time dependence are very much like the time dependence of operators in density matrix. In quantum theory, this relation between quantum mechanics and the canonical version of classical mechanics is quite surprising and turns out to be quite deep. This is sort of the canonical version of classical mechanics. And I point out once again the difference in sign between this equation and this equation. Okay. The statement that the divergence term in the dynamics vanishes is known as Liouville's theorem. This is a deep theorem about classical mechanics and is not true of most any other dynamical problem, at least any other dynamical problem I know of. This is a statement that volume elements in phase space are conserved in the course of the motion. That is, let me describe that in pictures. So I have a two, if I have n particles, I have a 6n dimensional phase space. I refuse to draw pictures even in three dimensions, so you'll just have to accept my funny pictures in two dimensions to represent what's going on. I'll start out at t equals 0 with some volume element in phase space, pq. Time goes on, and the system develops. Each value of p and q in here goes to another value of p and q at time t. This is t equals 0, now we're at time t. And you get an image of this region. That image might look like this, or in general, it will be much more hideously complicated. What you have is that this region goes into a region of the same volume. If the volume in phase space to begin with is omega, the volume in phase space, call it omega of 0, the volume in phase space after you come out here is omega of t, but that is the same volume even though the shape is different. The very same thing is true of any tiny subvolume in here. It goes into a subvolume of the same size. That means that if the density is constant inside of this region, since this region has volume omega, that density would be 1 over omega of 0. After the whole dynamics is done, the density is constant in this region. Rho is equal to 1 of over omega of t, which is equal to 1 over omega of 0. So the density hasn't changed inside of the region. Only thing that's changed is the shape of the region. We went forward too much. Okay. This is where we were. I jiggled my thing. My apologies for showing you where we're going. So let's see. This theorem is a statement that volume elements in phase space are conserved in the course of motion. That just says once more what I said on that blackboard, so I won't say it again. This says once more that energy is conserved in virtue of this equation. If rho of p and q is any function of the Hamiltonian, okay, that's has new content. If rho of p and q is any function of the Hamiltonian, rho of p and q, no explicit time dependence, but but instead, let's say it's the Hamiltonian of P and Q squared. Nice function. If it's this, it is just as much conserved as it would be if it were e to the minus beta h. In fact, any function of the Hamiltonian is independent of time in virtue of this equation. Let me show it to you slowly. Yes, please.
The Liouville's theorem is coming from the fact that we consider a case where a Hamiltonian was time independent.
Correct.
Will it be true when the...
No, or rather... I'm sorry, I answered too quickly. Let me think. Liouville's theorem, I think, will remain true. However, the time independence of the Hamiltonian will fail. That is, in your classical mechanics course, you may have seen the mysterious equation, the h dt is equal to partial h dt. What on earth does this mean? Well, it means that if h is some function of p and q and t, and we have Hamiltonian mechanics, we calculate the time derivative of h because p is changing and q is changing. That cancels out, but the time derivative because t is changing does not cancel out. In particular, if h of p and q is equal to p squared over 2m plus u of q plus any function of t, the time derivative of h is the time derivative of that function. Okay? If rho is any function of the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is independent of time, this equation is true. If the Hamiltonian has time dependence, then the rho will have a time derivative, which is the partial derivative of h with respect of rho. I should write it up. Let me do the derivation of what I want, and then I'll get to the question of the time dependence. Let rho of t and q and t be any function at all of h of p and q and t and of t. That's the most general case, and after that, we're done, I think. So I will calculate the time derivative of rho this means that I'm holding this p and q fixed but changing t. That's what the partial derivative is about. I get two kinds of terms. One kind of term comes from the derivative of f with respect to t, right there. That's non-zero, which will be zero if there's no time dependence there. The next term is the derivative of f with respect to h. That's f depends on that h right here. And then I calculate the total time derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to time. But that total time derivative is the partial time derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to time by the calculation we did earlier. If f does not depend on t, and h does not depend on t, then you get zero. I've now done the general case. Almost many, many, many times in life, we want to calculate what happens when we have a time-independent Hamiltonian, in particular when we're looking for the relaxation of a system to equilibrium. We're thinking about a time-independent Hamiltonian, and we then ask, when will it be that this probability density will be independent of time? Should we use the word equilibrium to describe the situation in which that probability density is independent of time? Well, it's not the answer. We don't get out the answer that Maxwell and Boltzmann gave us. Maxwell, Boltzmann, and Gibbs said that not only do you get, it's not that you get the d rho dt equals zero when rho is any function of the Hamiltonian. Only when rho is e to the minus beta h over z do you get that equation be true. That's what they said. And that's embarrassing, because we used every single epsilon of fact from classical mechanics in saying that this general function of the Hamiltonian has its time derivative zero. So classical mechanics plus the statement that d rho dt equals zero is not enough to specify a unique equilibrium probability density for a classical system. Something else is needed in addition. If you ask me in addition what is needed for quantum mechanics, my answer will be, I do not know. That is, quantum mechanics is a richer problem. I don't know. OK. But let's stick with classical mechanics. It's hard enough. So any function of the Hamiltonian will do for our description of an equilibrium situation, maybe. At least if d rho dt equals zero is our goal in life. What is called the canonical ensemble, which is rho e to the minus beta h divided by z. This is appropriate for n fixed. It is appropriate, it is a correct fact that this will work for any large system with n fixed. It will also work, that is, it is also correct, as I will, I think, show you. It is also correct when we have a small system which forever has been in contact with a heat bath. I don't know how to draw a heat bath, so I'll say heat bath, and I will show a little contact. If our small system here has been in contact with a heat bath, it contains a fixed number of particles, it has been exchanging energy with that heat bath forever and ever and ever. This is the right expression for calculating rho. How do I know it's the right expression? I will show you later on that this is more or less true. I don't have a mathematical proof of it exactly, but, well, pretty good. Something is pretty good in that direction. But years of experience has said that that's so. This is the right way of setting up a problem. If we have a large system, or if a small system is weakly coupled to a larger one. This is okay to use if there are no other conserved variables besides the ones mentioned. That is n, the number of particles, which I hold fixed, and the Hamiltonian, which I'm taking into account here. There's more to be said about that. I've forgotten whether I said it on this slide or not. However, for many different I have to do escape. That's on the computer now, in my hand. I said escape. Don't you try to get away from me. Okay, so back one. So it says here, the right ensemble for use if any system with a known number of particles is weakly coupled to a larger system, so it might exchange energy with the heat bath, but this is okay to use if there are no other important conserved variables beyond the ones mentioned. If you have a system in motion, watch out for the momentum. If you have a galaxy spinning around, watch out for angular momentum. You have to take them into account explicitly in these two cases in setting up the ensemble. I thought there was a question. No, okay. The microcanonical ensemble. Microcanonical ensemble is the right thing to use for a large system. Anything works for a large system. Or for a small system, which has a fixed number of particles and is not connected to a heat bath and has no other important conserved variables in it. The microcanonical ensemble has a delta function of E, that's a number, minus H, that's a function of P and Q, divided by a normalization factor, which is called the structure factor, and is supposed to be chi of E. My computer thinks that chi should be made like an X, except a little below the line. This is chi of E in the conventional notation. This is the right ensemble to use if the energy and number of particles in a small system are known. This is okay to use if there are no other important conserved variables. However, small systems with a fixed energy can often have other hidden conserved variables. Let me show you a sort of example. Imagine that I have something that I can picture in two dimensions. Here's a two-dimensional system. It has walls that I've just drawn for you. Imagine that everything sits in this two-dimensional thing, and I have an orbit that looks like that. All the particles inside the orbit stay inside. All the particles outside the orbit stay outside. I've colored chalk. I should draw that. All the particles outside the orbit stay outside. There is a conserved variable which says whether you're inside or outside. So this condition says that we can't really get away with this. That's appropriate because if I started out with initial conditions so that I knew I was outside the orbit, I would stay outside. Worse yet, if I started out with initial conditions so I was on this orbit, I'd stay on the orbit and never go either inside or outside. In this case, it is often true for a very small system that there are other conserved variables and that you can't get away with this microcanonical ensemble. Grand canonical ensemble. That's the right thing to use in days when you don't have a conserved number of particles. we bring our heat, we bring our system back into contact with the heat bath, and we imagine that particles move up and back across this barrier. If particles move up and back across the barrier, the number of particles in here is not conserved, and you use an ensemble which, in which the probability density as a function of P and Q is, well, it isn't exactly a function of P and Q. It's a function of all the possible P's and all the possible Q's, because this Hamiltonian is a function of more P's if N is larger and fewer P's if N is smaller. This is a Hamiltonian, and energy is a function of P and Q. This is the number of particles. You do e to the minus beta H minus mu N divided by this. I don't remember what the name of that Greek letter is. I tell it to myself as the cascade particle, but that's certainly not the name of the Greek letter. This is what you do for the grand canonical ensemble. This is the right ensemble to use if a small system is weakly coupled to a larger system, so it might exchange energy and particles with a larger system. Again, it's OK to use if there are no other important conserved variables. I'm assuming in writing this that there's only one kind of variable. If there are lots of different kinds of variables, we have to worry about lots of different conservation laws, since there are lots of different conserved kinds of variables. There's supposed to be, at least in classical mechanics, a factor of 1 over n factorial for each kind of different kind of particle. Quantum mechanics, if the particles are identical, does without those extra factors of 1 over n factorial. For large systems and for most purposes, all the ensembles are equivalent to one another. Again, if there are no other important conserved variables. Why are all ensembles equivalent to one another? Well, because the fluctuations in the important quantities are small in any ensemble. And the average energy is proportional to the number of particles in the system, the average number of particles in the system. The mean square fluctuations in the energy are also proportional to n, average of n. But the root mean square fluctuations are proportional to the square root of n, as I have emphasized many times. The square root of n is much smaller than n, so fluctuations are small. So that it doesn't matter that n is varying in this grand canonical ensemble. Ensemble theory for large systems is the world's biggest bore. For small systems, well, statistical mechanics isn't so much about small systems, so it's a bore for that too. And I will go on beyond ensemble theory. However, I made an important point, and I'm going to say it again. For the simplest case in which H is that, then rho obeys this equation exactly, a time-independent solution of this equation, which would be that rho could be any function at all of H. This result stands in apparent contradiction to our knowledge of statistical mechanics, which tells us the probability distribution should be the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, that is, an exponential in H. What additional information should we bring to bear on this situation? Well, we already have a hint from the Brownian motion calculation that the Brownian motion calculation might or should give the Maxwell-Boltzmann result. Let's imagine we put in all of these terms, and we put in these terms to our calculation, and we then, that dot, 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 stands for these terms up here. And let's try to calculate a probability distribution for rho depending on both these terms and these terms, and see what happens, and see whether we get a unique answer. OK, I'm going to do it piece by piece. I'm going to bring into the equation for rho, first the p over tau term, because that's easy because we already did it. And then the stochastic term, that's hard. We haven't already done it. We're going to have to go back and do it again. So this P over tau term. We've done the general case. The general case, the time derivative of rho, from dynamical systems theory, has a result in which you get a derivative with respect to P of the velocity. The velocity, in this case, is P over tau, and minus the velocity if we're calculating the probability distribution. So we calculate the derivative with respect to the variable of minus the velocity, P over tau, times minus the generalized velocity. This is the velocity of the variable P in the space, times the probability density. How do I know that this derivative should be outside? Well, I know that this derivative should be all the way over on the left on general grounds. On general grounds, I know that the integral over everything in sight of this probability distribution has got to be independent of time. It is one well-known time-independent result. The way you get something which is independent of time is to have this be a derivative outside. Then when you integrate, you get results from P equals infinity, or P equals minus infinity, P equals plus infinity, where rho is zero, and you get a nice, zero for the time derivative of the integral of this over all p values. Blah, 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 blah. We can't just look up our old result to get the effect of the other term, of the result of stochastic kicks, eta of t, in the Brownian model. As we shall see in a bit, the average first order effect of this term is zero, but the effect of this term, or the effect of these kicks, the second order produces something proportional to the time that the kicks have been going on. Since we are doing a calculation, since in order to calculate the result of the our change in probability distribution, we did a calculation to first order in the time displacement. Our calculation has to include eta to second order. So we're going to go back to the beginning to assess these effects of these kicks and do our calculation to second order. I'm about to start a new calculation. Questions might come up. OK, so go all the way back to the beginning. The beginning is we have an equation for p. The pdt is eta of t, and we're going to forget about everything else for a moment. That says that the change in p over the time interval between t and t plus delta t is the integral ds eta of s over this. We have forgotten about everything else. We're thinking of delta t being a small quantity, so we can forget about, for example, the minus p over tau term. We once again do exactly what we did before. We're calculating the behavior by looking at the time t plus delta t. We will write things in terms of a probability distribution at time t, and then assess the effect of that delta t by looking at this delta p, the change in p. Dot, dot, dot means, I'm sorry, not the dot, 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 but the brackets, the thing around the dot, 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 is an average over the possible values of the stochastic variables eta of s for s between t and t plus delta t. That's what we got to take into account. That's what this bracket's going to be about. Our starting point is then that the average value of g at time, average over initial data, average over what we had at time t and average over what we are doing in the time interval delta t, in particular, average over what we're doing with this eta of t. This average is the integral of g of p times rho of p at time t plus delta t. That's what we mean by the average of g at time t plus delta t. And we have just calculated what that is. We started out with the value p at time t. We've moved forward to time t plus delta t, where we have the variable having the value p plus delta t. I will now expand this to second order in delta p and get a result to first order in delta t. I will get a result to first from a second order expansion, which is first order in delta t, because the first order term vanishes. And so I will, in the next 20 minutes, do this calculation. This is just the same calculation as the people do to estimate the effects of stochastic changes in prices on stock market variables based upon their theoretical understanding of the stock market. That's, I guess, next week's colloquium. It involves taking into account stochastic variables of this kind. So I'm going to write out this equation. On the left-hand side of the equation, I get, when I expand in delta t, I get the integral dp g of p and t plus delta t. I'm doing the first order expansion. Delta t times the integral dp g of p and t partial derivative with respect to t. I've now done the left-hand side of the equation. I next have to do the right-hand side of the equation. That is the average. First of all, there's a term just like this, and I'm going to forget about the term just like this. I will cross it out and not bother to write it out here. OK, I will write it out. That's the zeroth order term, which doesn't matter for anything. I have done the expansion in delta p to zeroth order. First order, which starts to count for something, is the average of delta p times the integral. That's the only thing there's an average over, since this is an average over this stuff. This is the integral dp, g of p, and delta t, the partial derivative with respect to p. And this term is 0 also. That's probably all on the next slide. OK, so I have done on that blackboard this, and this, and this, and I'm about to do this term. And yes, I have the correct factor of 2. Average of delta p squared plus the times the second derivative with respect to p of rho of p and t squared. I have looked at the effect of these terms. And then I say we cancel out this and this. We throw away this because it's 0, and we're left with this. The time derivative of rho of p and t is the average of delta p squared divided by 2 delta t. That the delta t came from there, the 2 came from there, times the second derivative with respect to p of rho of p and t. Before anything else happens, we notice that this is a second derivative. That's a time derivative. what we have is a sort of diffusion in momentum space, and that's a good thing to have gotten. But now we have to calculate this average of delta p squared. Delta p squared is equal to that. I don't seem to have the average sign as I should have here, so you have to imagine an averaging sign here. This is the integral, which, like this, I have done this integral before. It turns out to have the value gamma times delta t. It is linear in delta t. I did the integral before with an exponential decay factors in it. You can look it up. With the exponential decay factors left out, this is what the result of the calculation is. Oh, I should do it. This thing is the delta function of u minus s times gamma. Gamma times the delta function of u minus s. We have an integral du from t to t plus delta t, an integral ds from t to t plus delta t. This delta function acts precisely once, so we can do the integral ds and get 1, since u is in the same, has the same interval in it as s. We do this s integral and get 1 times gamma, and then we do the u integral and get delta t times gamma. So we end up with a result that rho diffuses in momentum with a diffusion constant, a gamma over 2. The result looks like this, gamma over 2 dp squared of rho of pt. Notice that this, that because this is diffusive, this result cannot be followed backward in time. We can only go forward. Notice also that we had to go to second order of our calculation to see the effect of our random kicks, because the second order effect is linear in delta t, and we were calculating all kinds of effects linear in delta t. We would not have to include the third order term, because it's not linear in delta t. So now we come out with an equation. I'll get my, your hands in a second. Well, let's do this on. Now get your hands first. You talk a little less.
Chase, what you put on the board there, you left out the votes.
There. Because it seems like you've written g's and no rows, and then you cancel. You say that this holds for any g. And then you're going to want to write what you've written on the slide in terms of rows. So.
Okay.
I'm kind of trying to follow what you did on the previous slide, getting to this one. And it seems like
you say what I got out of the box was nonsense. Okay, let's go. Let's assume that it's nonsense for a second, and follow what I did on. I get now more nonsensical as I get closer to noon. That just shows I should have lunch sometime. Let's go back and see whether I did right the first. Let's see whether I did right on the slide.
This does not exist. Evaporate. Okay. Yes.
There's a way of doing the calculation that way, but I don't want to do it that way. I did it. Rho of t plus delta t, g of p plus delta t times rho of t. Here I expand in delta t, and let's. So you will accept this one?
Yes.
And you will accept that I can move the delta p over to the other side of the equation, making a rho of p minus delta p. That's because delta p is independent of p. Now, once I have gone that far, I can take away this g, this integral with respect to g of p. I can take away the integral, and basically, I have, without the integration, rho p is c, rho, rho plus the second order term. That makes what's on the blackboard correct. The erases my sins. And now I have the right answer. But in the right intermediate steps. I always have the right answer, because I know the answer is wrong. So the right intermediate steps. Okay? Did you have this? No, you found another error. My harness. Please tell me about my other error.
Okay, my summary, we started with the probability density, which was a function of the position and momentum as in the first place. Then all of a sudden, we started considering just the momentum.
Okay. Yes, there is a correct worry. And you could imagine there was a hidden text there, or Q there. Since the calculation doesn't care about that, I didn't include it. What I did was erase everything irrelevant. And the Q is irrelevant to this piece of the calculation because P doesn't, because the equation for P doesn't care about Q, and Q isn't changing.
So, in effect,
so I did it right, but sloppy. I should have carried along everything that Q every time. Thank you for pointing out my problems. At this stage, there was no problem. We expanded rho properly. We moved everything into rho, got rid of the green top. I have to go back and say that. Once we got this far, we could take off this integral. I said that, but I'll say it again. Since this is true for every function, g of p, and q under the integral sign, it must be true that this guy is equal to that guy without the integral sign and without the g of p. So this was a true equation for rho, and then I can proceed. This expectation value, I emphasize once again, is the expectation value averaging over the values of eta between C and T plus delta. Those of you who have done this calculation or seen this calculation before will recall that they saw it doing either Ito calculus or Stratonovich calculus. I did neither, I just did the calculation. There, and now we have the equation. We have something we put all together. We have the time derivative of p at x and t is dot dot dots. The dot dot dots come from the Hamiltonian terms. I can put them in, but now I wanted to put in the two Einstein terms, the two terms that depended on grounding motion. The first term is the term that arises because of the stochastic effects of the random kicks. It is gamma over 2, the average strength of the random kicks, times the second derivative with respect to p of rho. The other term is what arises because we have a slowing down because of the 1 with p over tau, and that's the derivative of p over tau times rho. Then we have some terms that have a Hamiltonian behavior. We will leave out these terms for the moment. 5 minutes. Finish up in 5 minutes. Okay, I want, I've left out the terms that come from the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to t times the derivative of rho with respect to x and so forth. An equation like the one here obtained averaging over the stochastic mechanics of a Langevin equation. The Langevin equation, the one with the random ticks in it, is called the Fokker-Planck equation. Notice that this stuff is ancient history. I don't know who Fokker was, but Planck is the same Planck as we know from quantum mechanics. We look for a time-independent solution of this equation to see what is the equilibrium behavior. That's our goal, remember, we're looking for equilibrium behavior. We write rho of p, x, and t is some exponential of q of p and x, plug it in, and we demand that we get zero. Zero is the p integral of, well, from this term, we simply differentiate once with respect to p, and we get here a p over tau. We differentiate once with respect to p, we have left over a p integrate, a p derivative, which we take outside of everything, and we get gamma over 2 minus the derivative of q with respect to p plus p over tau. Wrong. I know too well what answer I want to get. The equation is dt rho of p and x and t is equal to Hamiltonian stuff plus gamma over 2, second derivative with respect to p. That's a correct rewriting of this equation.
Rho is e to the q, the minus sign, of p and x. I will move that q through this derivative. I then get equal gamma over 2 times the derivative with respect to p of space. I move this through here and get e to the minus q of t and x times bracket minus the derivative with respect to p of q of t and x plus t over tau. And I want this to be equal to 0. You will notice that I left out here this factor. That's because the next thing I did was said, let's choose q is equal to p squared over gamma. Let's choose, there is a gamma over 2 here and not there. The next thing I did was say, let's choose q is p squared over gamma tau plus some function of x, where c of x is a constant of integration. I have a right to a certain number of constants of integration in an equation of this kind. And since we have derivatives with respect to p, any function of x is a constant of integration. And then I notice that this term cancels against that one. And I don't have the factor that I didn't put in doesn't count for anything. And I get 0 right at this stage. So now I have something of the right form. Since this product is beta, since this product is 2m over beta. That was the equation we got at the beginning for the consistent version of the Einstein equations. In order to make this dot, dot, dot equal to 0, we have to choose C of x is equal to u over kt, since that's what comes to make this term in the usual Hamiltonian mechanics 0. Recall that this term in the usual Hamiltonian mechanics is minus is p over m times a d. P over m times dx minus the gradient dxu times derivative with respect to p of rho. The only way of making this term vanish, that which I just wrote on the board vanish, is to choose c of x is equal to that. When we're all done, we have p squared over 2m times beta plus u of x times beta. And when we're all done, we have rho, which is of the form that we need in order to satisfy the structure of Maxwell, Boltzmann, and so forth. This is the structure of a derivation, an honest-to-goodness derivation of the Maxwell-Boltzmann stuff. It is not sufficient to say that the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is a consequence of Hamiltonian mechanics. It's just not true. It is not a consequence of Hamiltonian mechanics. You need an additional stochastic element, which is exactly what I put in here, or rather Einstein put in, by putting in the relaxation with the p over tau and the stochastic kicks with the eta. Hamiltonian mechanics, when supplemented by some stochastic assumption, will give the Maxwell-Boltzmann equilibrium distribution, at least in this simple one-particle case. At the end of this series of this particular part of the series of lectures, I have a derivation in the general case. We will now go on, however, to talk about how Boltzmann did it with particle collisions. The one reason why we're going to do the result with the particle collisions is that it looks sort of like the scattering theory you do in field theory. And it provides the analogous classical physics to the scattering event that you do in field theory. It then provides you with a way of approaching this problem through Hamiltonian mechanics. It is, what we're going to do next time is rather special in that it involves weakly interacting particles. We will then go on to do something which isn't in the notes, which is more general, this heat bath thing. And then we go on to do other things. This is the structure of these lectures, is to get at this point in the next lecture, in the next lecture, a derivation of Maxwell-Boltzmann stuff, which is somewhat more general and involves particle collisions. Questions or comments? Yes, please.
So it was always my impression that things like air molecules in a room are sufficiently separated that they're essentially classical. Yes?
It depends for what purposes. We don't. The right answer is, to some extent, we don't know. If you look at the uncertainty principle, the uncertainty principle gives some sidewise uncertainty of the particle. If we have a collision event in which a particle is coming in and has some sidewise uncertainty. This is an uncertainty in this direction. It's enough to make us unsure of exactly how the collision will occur. The collisions are more quantum mechanical than you might think, although the whole gas itself is pretty classical. The answer to your question is yes, it's reasonably.
Okay, so I guess the partially answer is my next question, which is, so if you use the approximation that air is totally classical, we know that we do get thermal equilibrium, but, you know, like if you look at two boxes of air which are connected, one of them, if you look at one of them, it is in the Boltzmann distribution, even though the whole system is only governed by classical mechanics with no stochastic component. So there must be some sense in which...
Can't be true. That is, you have to have a stochastic component intervening someplace in order to get the classical, in order to get the maximum Boltzmann result. That is, let's go back to the colloquium we heard yesterday. The universe has a long history, and in that history, lots of things happen to the particles. Lots of things that happen put them into equilibrium, according to, in almost all situations, according to our speaker of yesterday. If you look at any box of air, that box went through its history. That history gave it lots and lots and lots of opportunities to get kicks in various directions. It is not anything we could describe as deterministic. There have been an awful lot of opportunities to be kicked around, and indeed to be quantum mechanical by sort of the same argument that I described, or the quantum mechanicalness of it isn't necessary for the Maxwell Boltzmann thing to hold. Stochastic is a property of prior history, and prior history almost always includes lots of randomization events. That's why entanglement, just to go on to a slightly different topic, but basically is sort of the same topic. That's why wave functions are essentially always entangled, because their past history always provided an opportunity for entanglement. And if we have history of almost any kind, we will get an equilibrium distribution. Remember what you have to do in the full table in order to get something which is not random. You have to put those balls in a little container and hold them in there so that they're in there. You pick up the container, and then you go beep, just one shot, and the balls are all over the place, and some stochastic representation is much, much better than the deterministic representation of what happens. Stochastic is easy to produce, and once produced is entirely stable.
Stochastic Maxwell Boltzmann.
Yes and no. Yeah. There is friction on the full table. Friction is produced by the balls rolling around, little pieces of them breaking off to some extent by the friction is not necessarily classical, but we can produce models of it which are classical and give us some inkling of what things are about. You want to believe that there is some connection between quantum and stochastic.
No, just the opposite.
You want to believe there's some connection between classical and stochastic. Either way, it's true. They both will produce stochasticity in various ways, and anything you do will produce it. Chaos is ubiquitous. Mess is there always and can be produced in a large variety of ways. Order is hard to get. That was the, that was, I think, the lesson of the colloquium. And it's, I think, the lesson of looking at nature. In order to get things that are not chaotic, you have to do stuff which is very special. You purify silicon, and you put electrons in it very carefully. That produces mass spectrometric results. But any old messy material is always all messy. Okay? Onward to lunch.
I couldn't listen to the first half.